Welcome, everyone. This is the LaRue Show for Saturday, January 10, 2015. That makes it the second of the new year, and already this year is momentous, it's dangerous, but it's very promising if we do what we have to, we have hope. And the topic that we're going to be discussing today is how the BRICS is bringing the American system to the Americas. Specifically, we are going to hear more about, among other things, the groundbreaking for the startup of the Nicaragua Canal, the Transoceanic Canal, which is itself bringing the maritime Silk Road through our own hemisphere. And that is the cover feature on the January 9th Executive Intelligence Review. It says Nicaragua's Canal, the Maritime Silk Road, comes to the Americas. And I'll just mention in passing, I may not have said, you may recognize me, Marcia Mary Baker. I'm glad to be back here again in 2015. But we are pre-taping our show January 8th, 2015, partly for scheduling reasons, but it turns out the timing is perfect because right now in Beijing, January 8th and 9th, is a first ever kind of meeting between the nation of China, it's taking place in Beijing, and representative of 30 nations from the Americas. And our guest today, who will be discussing this development and related developments, is Cynthia Rush, who has been a longtime Ibero-American correspondent for Executive Intelligence Review, an associate in the International LaRouche effort. So it's a great opportunity that we have. Cynthia, welcome.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Good. And as I said, I'll just say a few more things. This really what amounts to an institutional initiative for humanity between Ibero-America and Beijing. We'll hear more about. I think United States and Canada are outstandingly not there. Cynthia can correct me in a minute. And I want to also say that Cynthia was a special contributor to the new Executive Intelligence Review special report that came out in December, how the new Silk Road becomes the world land bridge. In particular, she contributed to the grid of the explosion of initiatives since the meeting last summer in Brazil of the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South African nations, and other Ibero-American nations. So we're going to get into this in a few seconds, but I want to say right at the outset of this discussion that this whole development thrust is an essential inherent part of the international anti-war effort on our part, effort against terrorism. You've seen recently this January 7th early morning terrorist outbreak in Paris, because what's associated with the conditions and the deployment of terrorism is this crazy, evil element of the world that's persisting. Well, it's falling apart, but it's in its death throes. The Wall Street City of London, imperial kind of axis, whose monetary system is indeed blowing out, but the elements within this are staging acutely dangerous provocations against Russia, demonizing China, causing flare-ups and warfare and loss of life across Southwest Asia, North Africa. And so the development drive of the BRICS for science, for a whole new platform for power for the world, in particular towards fusion energy, bringing that online and upgrading the productive base of all of humanity. This is the clincher opposition to this insane war provocation gang. Now, in that regard, the reason I'm pointing this out again, many of you who listen to the show will agree with me on what I just said, but be sure you have seen for yourself the January 7th Capitol Hill press conference that took place by Congressman and former Senator Bob Graham, who are focused in particular on the getting declassified a whole chapter of the Congressional Inquiry Report on what was behind 9/11. There's a 28-page chapter that focuses on funding behind it. And as we know from, we don't have to have any secrets revealed, we know in general that outstandingly Saudi Arabia was involved in this, the same that's involved in collaborating with London in geopolitics that can blow up the world, that's causing terrorism and strife and undermining all of Southwest Asia right now. So the congressman, including a bipartisan congressman, Walter Jones, the Republican, Stephen Lynch, the Democrat, Thomas Massey couldn't be there, but he's a Republican, and others, including spokesmen for the, actual family members of those who lost, whose family members lost lives in the Pentagon and Trade Towers assault in 2001. They spoke at this press conference. It's had already a ripple effect of coverage in other media, CNN, Fox News, but watch it for yourself, and the EIR from mid-January will carry all of the remarks of Bob Graham and the other people at that event. So, but now let's switch to our topic today and turn to Beijing, where January 8th is the first day of a two-day event. And Cynthia, could you take up the breaking news and what's happening and put us in the picture on that?
Sure. Well, this is a two-day meeting, began today, and it's really quite stunning in terms of the representatives. As you said, 30 nations. There are 33 nations represented in CELAC, which is the Community of Latin American and Caribbean Nations.
Let me ask you, that goes all the way through Mexico, right?
Yeah.
So
Mexico,
it is truly only Canada and the U.S. who aren't
right.
there?
Right. As people may know, there's the Organization of American States, which includes Canada and the U.S., which has always been a problem for the nations of Ibero-America. But this is excludes those two nations, and I believe it was set up explicitly for that purpose because both the U.S. and Canada have turned their backs on the countries that should be their natural allies, following instead the British imperial financier policy of London and Wall Street. In any case, you have this is a foreign minister gathering. However, there are many, many other government officials from all of these nations, including industry ministers, finance ministers, infrastructure, energy, etc. And there's an array of, outside the forum itself, a whole range of bilateral meetings and discussions going on as these government officials seek aid, real financial aid for what they have in mind for their own countries, industry, infrastructure development in particular. That's a key priority area. And today, the president of China, Xi Jinping, addressed that grouping. And really what has been put forward, the whole environment there is one of tremendous optimism, tremendous enthusiasm for development perspective that has been put forward there. And as he emphasized, I think the slogan of this meeting is, it's called a new platform, a new starting point, and new opportunities. And what he laid out in his speech was really elaborating on what that means in terms of bilateral cooperation between China and all of the nations of the Caribbean and Central and South America, including Mexico. And he said every CELAC country, no matter whether it's rich or poor, is equal under the framework of this forum. And he emphasized that the kind of South-South cooperation that is reflected in these agreements or this alliance is leading to a new world economic order that is just and fair for all members. So, you know, he gave his speech was one of really laid out in great detail a whole array of agreements. He said, we're guided by the 1+3+6 formula, meaning one program, three motors, and six priority areas. The three motors are trade, investment, and financial cooperation. And he said, this has to be revved up. The motors have to be revved up to their full potential in the next 5 years. What are the six priority areas? We're putting together agreements on a series of great projects for cooperation in energy, natural resources, building infrastructure, agriculture, manufacturing, and information and innovation technology. So he went through some details, if I can mention later, of a number of different kinds of funds, financing for infrastructure, for energy. They're going to set up all sorts of scholarships for students from the Latin American Caribbean to go to China, a Young Scientists Association, you know, $20 billion credit line for infrastructure, $10 billion for a preferential credit line, $20 billion, oh, I said that, $5 billion, another $5 billion infrastructure fund. But overall, what he's talking about, he said specifically, over the next 10 years, China intends to double its trade with the region. It was $257 billion in 2013. And then over the next, that would double that to $500 billion, and then increase in, over the next 5 years, direct investment to $250 billion. So we're talking about very large sums of money here, but the emphasis is on great projects that will, as he said, these can be must be mutually beneficial in the context of his win-win strategy. We have common interests. We can help each other, always with the focus being on development. He said, we have a fever for Latin America and the Caribbean. This is how our fever is being expressed through this array, spectacular array of projects and financing.
And you told me earlier today, he also quantified this in terms of how much China and these nations represent in terms of population and so forth.
Yes. Let me see if I can find it. They said you combine these, China and the Latin America, Caribbean, we represent 1/5 of the planet in terms of territory, a 1/6 of the words of the world's population, and the 1/7 part of the world economy. Like sort of the 1/7 largest region in the world economy, right? So that's a pretty large group.
Well, let me ask you this, because already amidst whatever these agreements, and I guess there's another 24 hours to go, and more, and there'll be more will be released to the media and agreed to. But there are spectacular transportation. Among the projects are spectacular transportation commitments, right? The railroad across the South American continent, and the Transoceanic Canal, Nicaragua. Mm-hmm. Could you give us the update on that?
Well, the Nicaragua Canal, which, as you said, we have a feature in EIR this week. On that and the interview with the president of the Nicaragua's National Agrarian University, who's also the spokesman for the great Interoceanic Canal Commission, Dr. Talavera. This is a spectacular project, which in fact is not new, because American patriots and government 150 years ago put forward a proposal for it. The Nicaragua Canal, the Nicaragua as a location has always been spelled out as an area for another canal, or even before the Panama Canal.
Because it has the, I understand, it'll make use of the lake
right
there, which is the largest in Central America.
Right.
Well, it's a lowland area,
right,
and there's a
right, Lake Nicaragua.
Handy lake.
Right. As Dr. Talavera points out, this would have an extraordinarily beneficial impact, not just for Nicaragua, but for the entire region in terms of, aside from the transportation issue. And it's important to point out that the Nicaraguans don't see this as a competition to the Panama Canal. They see it as something complementary. It's the Chinese HKND group, which is financing it, they also have said, not a competition. The Panama Canal is in the process of being expanded as well, I think, and that's going to be ready.
Maybe 2016.
Yeah, within a couple of years. And I should mention that a colleague of ours was just in Panama, and he noted that people he spoke to there saw absolutely no problem with the Nicaraguan Canal. They thought it was very interesting and certainly not as competition to Panama. Within a framework of a global or regional development focus, it certainly shouldn't be. What Dr. Talavera points out is, of course, this, you know, you need to, and keep in mind that Nicaragua is a poor country, as are all of the countries in that region, who have been plagued for a couple of centuries by the British Empire and its slave owners and their agents in the U.S., the filibusters, who in the mid-19th century decided they were going to expand into Central America to build their slave empire, and more recently, drug trade, civil war. The United Fruit Company, so famous for transporting cocaine and the bananas.
Yeah, the famous expression, Banana Republic.
Right.
And
right.
Also,
right.
We can't diss Costa Rican coffee. It may be one of the best in the world. But in other words, to have only an export-oriented
right.
Approach
right.
to the entire Caribbean
right.
region.
Right.
And in recent years, the bioenergy bubble, cane ethanol
right.
encouraged.
Exactly.
This reached very low, degraded.
Exactly.
So
conditions. You have one of the poorest, most degraded, disease ridden, drug trafficking ridden regions of the world. The drug cartels, you have people who've, you know, hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions, who've left the region.
Yeah, we should. You can say El Salvador, at least a third of the entire population.
Right. Honduras, of course, we all saw recently the big hullabaloo about the children who came to the, you know, arriving
yes.
at the U.S. border.
From Honduras.
But people are escaping this horrific existence of, you know, drugs, violence, incredible violence. Honduras is the murder capital of the world, practically, or Central America. So here in the middle of that situation, you're proposing this marvelous project that can revolutionize, transform this region, train and educate human resources, young people in particular, as Dr. Talavera emphasizes. We can lift up our young population and give them optimism and hope for the future. And, you know, you will create enormous demand. If you raise people's living standards, then you'll create demand for food. Farmers will have to produce more food. Yes, they'll probably have to join forces with some international and foreign companies for cooperation and expertise. They'll have to perhaps continue importing certain products as well. Right now, I mean, as it starts, this is a 5-year project, and they just broke ground on December 22nd. So it's a revolutionary project that will completely transform the region, and also is a component of the much broader land-bridge perspective, which includes rail lines from North America down through Central America, through the Darien Gap, which connects Central and South America, down into the interior of South America. And you can go back to James Blaine in the mid-1870s and 80s, who was, you know, a real American system representative, presidential candidate. And he and the Army Corps of Engineers proposed a whole series of rail lines that they wanted to be built from North America down to Brazil and Argentina, right? And that's 150 or more years ago. So this perspective is not new. The only problem is the United States has abandoned that American system perspective, and now it's been taken up by China. And the United States should be part of that, because we have to understand the CELAC, the China-CELAC Forum, as a component of the BRICS. It really is. The United States has to be part of that, should be part of it. It's not. And of course, our efforts are right now to mobilize to ensure that that happens.
Yes, when you were saying Nicaraguan gentleman who's the Agronomy University president, who gave an interview, who is the spokesman for the project, among many things that he was emphasizing, he was saying, we've had enough geopolitics in the world, we need some geoeconomics. Right. And when you were just describing one of the early America, one of the figures of the post-Civil War period that wanted railroads around the world, Mr. Blaine, and they were collaborating, and the Trans-Siberian arose from this. And after, and because of what you could call the Lincoln faction in the United States, we crossed our own continent, east-west. But, you know, we never had the geoeconomics of crossing north-south to be able to go through Manitoba or Saskatchewan, down through the Dakotas, down into Texas. We went east-west. We don't go north-south. We do along the Mississippi, but we should have a grid, a density, what they call in Eurasia and what's called by railroad men everywhere, connectivity. We don't have any connectivity inside the United States, right. And we have much less. The peak of our rail grid was in the 1920s. So we could go on about this, but just to throw in the, to underscore this, our effort to have Americans right now sign the petition for America joining the BRICS effort, and joining in particular Chinese President Xi's invitation to President Obama in November, when Obama went to the Asian Pacific Economic APEC meeting. That's what we should do. And so Americans of every, you don't have to, you can have a fancy ID or not, or be a lawmaker or not, but we, anyone listening who hasn't signed already the petition and gotten it around, now is the time, because the this momentum you're describing there, it is the wind is in our sails.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
So would you say more too about the, you mentioned December 22nd they broke ground, and I understand that's for the, it's like site prep for the roads that are going to carry the equipment, the food, the vehicles that will, they say it'll be done, they hope in September 2015, so then they can start actually the excavation and the hardcore work like that. That's with a five-year timetable, which is really fabulous. But also, there was a commitment made to run a railroad and cross east-west the continent of South America, which was never done.
Exactly. Yeah, that's another example of American system proposal. And of course, today you do have, which came out of the July BRICS meeting.
Yeah, if you could go through
yeah,
that.
Yeah, a proposal to build a intercontinental railroad from Brazil There are actually a couple of different routes that have been proposed, which could go through Brazil, Bolivia to Peru.
Or Brazil, Peru, and then southward,
Right,
or both.
right.
Yeah, or somewhat both.
And financed by China. And if you go back again to the mid 19th, well, 1870s, where you had a Peruvian president, Pardo, who, absolutely following the American system, proposed a trans-Andean railroad. And earlier you had Henry Meigs, the great American railroad entrepreneur who was in Peru, who proposed building a railroad across the Andes. And part of those enemies so ridiculed this proposal, they called it the railroad to the moon.
Oh.
Right? But he had this expansive view of connecting the two, Atlantic and Pacific. And he was working with collaborators from the United States, from the Lincoln faction in the United States. So when you see this coming out of the BRICS summit in Brazil, this is absolutely something that we used to do, and no longer do. I should just add also that, a couple of days ago, there was a White House briefing on when President
Oh yeah,
the
this.
President of Mexico, Peña Nieto, was I think on Tuesday he was here for a state visit, and the White House gave a briefing on just sort of the perspective, but the entire thing was so fraudulent because they tried to somehow portray Obama as a great ally of South America and said he had wonderful partnerships with all of the leaders of South America and had traveled there. And Joe Biden had traveled, made 10 trips to South America, had just come back from the inauguration of the Brazilian president. And, that this really shows how wonderfully the U.S. is engaged in South America, which, of course, is a complete lie.
Yeah.
And then capped it off by saying that really the focal point for Mexico in particular, but
Okay.
also for the rest of the continent, is to pass the Trans-Pacific Partnership, this imperial project, which is aimed at China. And has nothing to do with development or anything else. It's to benefit large corporations and take away what little sovereignty many of these 12 member nations currently have. So I thought that was pretty revealing.
Right, and if you look at the recent time where, as you said, it was just lies, the first this first week in January, where the president of Mexico is visiting Washington, D.C., and the White House just says they love us in South America and we're wonderful. But the Obama administration has been a continuation of those kinds of misery backward policies. That if you take energy and power, where characterize the Bush administrations, where that's where the in 2005, the Bush administration passed the U.S. Energy Act that insisted on so much biofuels and ethanol, so that we went from our corn production, which Mexico was supposed to import under free trade laws, which was stupid anyway, and went from 2% going into ethanol to 10 to 20 to now 40% going to ethanol. And I think Jeb Bush, who just the first week of January announced he's going to be God's gift to the fascist presidency of the United States, except we're going to commit to make sure that doesn't happen. But he was very involved, I think, in the biofuels fight,
Absolutely.
and it's a complete coherency between this Bush Obama White House operation, right?
Absolutely.
Jeb Bush.
Jeb Bush was a member of the Inter-American Ethanol Commission,
I see.
which was set up with a whole crew of hedge fund managers and financiers and politicians who figured they would make a killing on setting up these types of ethanol operations in South America. Brazil was a big target in particular. And, of course, they already had a
cane,
very...
ethanol.
Yeah, sugar cane. Mm-hmm. Or satanic sugar, as the Brazilian sugar cane workers call it.
Yeah.
Because of the brutal conditions that they work and live under. Not so surprisingly, the other component of that was Al Gore. So you had Al Gore...
Jeb Bush and Al Gore.
Working in tandem with Jeb Bush's Inter-American Ethanol Commission. At the same time as this whole discussion was taking place, Al Gore was traveling to Argentina and Chile to give these big ethanol, green, you know, no energy conferences. Mm-hmm. So, you know, having Jeb Bush come into claim... His other claim to fame is that he's got a—he really loves Hispanics, and that his wife is Mexican, and he really understands them, and he'll be great on immigration, and blah blah blah. It's just completely fraudulent.
Well, while we're at it, let's also point out who else. The other character pedigree of the opposition to the railroads in South America, to the new Nicaraguan transoceanic canal, that you've had repeated, the environmentalists has had the pedigree of Prince Charles saying we have to save the swamps and the trees, and recently, I guess it's Prince William saying you have to save animal life, at least in Africa, I don't know. But it's so, couldn't be more in your face, but I'm not crediting it with a great deal of power, but there's a lot of publicity to the environmentalist opposition. Would you say something
exactly.
about that?
Exactly. Well, let's not say interestingly. Let's say...
disgustingly.
Disgustingly and certainly expected. On the very day that the canal, work on the canal started, on December 22nd, you had the former foreign minister of Colombia, and keep in mind the president of Colombia is a very close ally of Tony Blair and the royal family. A former foreign minister, Noemí Sanín, came out with announced that she and a former deputy justice minister of Colombia were filing a complaint with UNESCO against the canal, claiming, one, invoking a border dispute with Nicaragua, which goes back, you know, decades, if not a century. They have a dispute.
Oh, over islands.
Over the San Andres Islands.
Yeah.
Right,
mm-hmm.
This archipelago. So claiming, one, that it's going to threaten the islands, but claiming also that, and this is the basis for the UNESCO suit, that it threatens the Seaflower Biosphere Reserve, which also includes those disputed islands. And they are calling on the president, Santos, Tony Blair's friend, to join with them in attacking the canal. Now, let's just look at the Seaflower Biosphere Reserve, which is administered jointly by the Colombian government and UNESCO. It encompasses 350,000 square kilometers of sea, and including the islands, but also all the people who live within it.
Oh my.
So.
You mean they're like a human zoo?
Yeah. So, and of course, the other aspect of that is a huge, unbelievable propaganda campaign directed against HKND, claiming that, you know, they're a shadowy group, they're unknown, who is the head of the company, he's very sleazy looking, whatever, you know, which completely ignores the fact that you have some very prestigious Chinese and other agencies involved in the planning of the canal. You have the Zhangjiang Institute of Survey, Planning, Design, and Research, which designed the canal route. And
they've done other some they or their
associates. Yeah, which like the Three Gorges Dam, which they also worked on. So, I mean, these are agencies that also worked on China's South Water North project, the China Railway, Siyuan Survey. I mean, all just, you know, to say that these are unknown shadowy groups.
Outstanding, large,
yeah.
Successful.
Absolutely.
Engineering, geoengineering.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they're pretty desperate, obviously.
Yeah, I was going to say, it makes it that much clearer that they're, it's not that, shows that they're powerful, but they have to resort to mm-hmm. anything, grab for anything mm-hmm. like this. And we'll see more when that, we may see more of that before we're finished and on our way. Okay. Now, and let me ask you one about the what you were speaking about earlier on the way this for Central America and for the immediate nations and populations, it's tremendous, and for the world as a whole. The way this can help serve, for example, some of the fabulous, some of the most conspicuous useful things to mankind, such as Brazil, that has in effect an iron ore mountain. And Brazil was one of the biggest exporters of iron ore. So looking ahead, this kind of canal, it depends on how this Nicaragua canal will be able to accommodate the largest cargo mm-hmm. vessels in mm-hmm. comparison to even Panamax when it opens, and even the Suez when it opens as an expanded. Mm-hmm. Do you want to say more about that, the famous hematite mountain in Brazil, or the volume of trade it can accommodate? I will point out, I'm baiting my guest Cynthia to say what she wants to or not, but you'll find a lot of the data, which we won't go through here on the air, in the January 9th issue of EIR, because there are charts and maps about huge world flows of basic bulk commodities like coal, iron ore, and otherwise container shipping.
Yeah, you know what? I don't have off the top of my head the details on that.
Yeah.
Brazil is, I believe, the largest iron ore supplier to China. Is that correct?
Yeah, it could be. China itself has upped its output amazingly in production.
Mm-hmm.
So it's larger than Brazil, larger than Australia or the rest of the world. But Brazil is a big supplier.
Mm-hmm.
And, for example, and a great deal of it does go to China, as well as otherwise China gets it from Australia and so forth. So it's just looking, it's very forward looking for the whole planet to be able to be on a whole new platform of resources, not merely extraction, but to get from here to there to where we can be, look forward to through a transition into nuclear fission to get to a fusion-based economy where we don't have to haul everything around. We can start to have a fusion torch and make resources.
Right, and obviously, I mean, China obviously does purchase large quantities of raw materials from South America, iron ore, food.
Food, soybeans,
right?
And
soybeans,
corn and wheat.
Oil from Venezuela. But what I found interesting also is the focus coming out of the China-CELAC meeting in Beijing is Xi Jinping's speech. He said, we're not just interested in raw materials. Yes, we need them, but we need manufacturing. We need South America, Central America, Caribbean, we want to help provide them with the means for increasing manufacturing, science, technology, and building infrastructure, right? Now, you know, the British imperial policy, and certainly in all of Latin America in the 19th century, they built railroads for one purpose only, which was to get out the raw materials, you know, to carry them to port.
Copper from Chile or
right,
phosphates. Or,
right. And, of course, when countries like Argentina or Brazil nationalized their railroads, that they didn't endear themselves to the British, which they did. But
well, I wonder if you could say now, I didn't I don't want to interrupt you if you
Don't,
want to,
no.
but we, because we were making the contrast with the Bush and Obama administrations, with Jeb Bush and Al Gore on biofuels, everything subversive and degraded. But since the July meeting in Fortaleza in Brazil of the BRICS and other nations, nuclear power is back on the agenda and is underway. Do you want to say a few things about that in South
yes,
America?
Yes. Well, out of that, the summit, the meetings that were held, they're both bilateral meetings that Xi Jinping had with several heads of state. And then he did a tour after that of four nations. But they signed bilateral agreements for nuclear energy with Brazil, with Argentina. Russia signed an agreement with Bolivia for nuclear energy, right? China's going to help Bolivia develop a second satellite. The first one was launched last year. And you have nuclear energy agreements possibly being discussed with Peru, which has a kind of incipient nuclear program. So this is a key focus. Mexico, of course, really abandoned their nuclear energy program after 1982. They had had a very aggressive program under López Portillo, who left office in 82, to build 10 nuclear plants. Today they have one, which is functioning, right? So nuclear energy is absolutely a focus. And of course, you know, we have nations of India, which is building nuclear plants, Russia, China, some phenomenal number of plants. And, you know, you do have Greenpeace and other environmental groups that are hysterically mobilizing against that. But one thing I should mention also is, you know, Mr. LaRouche has said repeatedly, and we've seen since the BRICS summit, the way in which pretty much the whole continent, Mexico more tentatively, but has lined up with the BRICS perspective. Brazil, of course, is a member of the BRICS. Argentina is lined up. In this summit in Beijing, you had the presidents of Venezuela, Ecuador, Costa Rica, and the Bahamas, who make up the four-nation leadership of CELAC, but they were also there for state visits, and they signed, each one of them, an array of bilateral agreements for, you know, all sorts of infrastructure development, but energy, transportation, education, science, etc. So, but you also have a pretty concerted effort on the part of the London Wall Street imperial apparatus to destabilize those nations that are most lined up with the BRICS, starting with Brazil itself. The president was just re-elected and inaugurated just last week, on January 1st. And
Dilma Rousseff.
Argentina has been under assault for years. But
yeah, before we finish, I want you to give us the latest update on that. But go ahead.
You know, they've tried using their vulture funds to literally bring down the government of Argentina. But now you have the vulture funds aiming at Brazil as well. And you look at publications like the London Economist, the Financial Times, the Wall Street Journal, these guys are all just chomping at the bit to try to use a bribery and corruption scandal that erupted around the Brazilian oil firm Petrobras, which is not entirely a state company. It's sort of partially privatized, but it's gigantic and Brazil has enormous oil resources to be developed. But they're trying to use the fact that Dilma Rousseff was the president of the board of directors of Petrobras from 2003 to 2010 to claim that she knew about the corruption that was going on, which included, you know, paying construction companies and kickbacks and all sorts of things. And the implication has already been made by The Economist, that she could be impeached, right? She narrowly won re-election, but she did win re-election. And it's a tenuous situation in some respects. It's a coalition of different political parties, which is going to be rough to hold together. So they're using this in particular, and you have one of the key vulture funds, Aurelius Capital, which is still in court with Argentina, trying to get paid back the full face value of bonds that they bought up for pennies on the dollar after the default of 2001. And they're demanding Argentina has to pay them back, and they claim that they're creditors, which of course is a total lie. But now Aurelius is trying to push Petrobras into default, claiming that they did not make their third quarter earnings available as they were supposed to do, and that they violated the bond contract. So they're pushing to get this country into default, which would, if it were to occur, and think also in the context of the falling oil prices, which have affected Brazil and Venezuela and many other oil-producing countries, as a major destabilization, and also seeing if they can somehow use this against Rousseff personally to get her out, as, you know, the impeachment issue is being discussed. So that also is reflects the kind of desperation and insanity of the transatlantic system, which is dead, about to implode, against these nations that have said, okay, our allies are the BRICS. That's our future. This is how we're going to develop. And they're determined. Venezuela is also has been under tremendous, you know, destabilization forces for the past year. The oil price drop has affected them, which is also interesting that in Beijing, President Maduro signed a number of agreements with China, but China was very explicit that they want to stabilize the Venezuelan government and they want to help, the economy is so battered by the oil price drop. They are actually going to be infusing money.
Yeah, I hear there's a credit line aspect,
right,
an investment aspect.
Right. $20 billion.
Yes.
Obviously they import oil from Venezuela, but they want to develop energy resources, oil, more oil resources. So that to me is a very important political intervention in terms of Venezuela is a large country. It's an oil-producing country that's important. And the Project Democracy apparatus that we've seen at work in Ukraine and Georgia and elsewhere has been right in there in Venezuela for the past year, financing the opposition groups that are demanding that Maduro be overthrown, basically. And you see that in Ecuador as well. So that's important to keep in mind.
Right. And one side aspect, if you care to say anything about it, is when you say Argentina's been very active in with the BRICS, I mean, it's not a member, it's right there in the alignment,
right,
the world
right.
alignment.
Mm-hmm.
And when the transatlantic system, London and the White House, have insisted on these sanctions against Russia, Argentina and other nations stepped up and said, we're going to collaborate, we're going to make new food arrangements, we're going to export, mm-hmm. to Russia. Would you say something about that?
Well, as you said, I mean, many of the South American nations have a capability for producing. Argentina immediately made a whole series of agreements, but other countries as well, Chile, Peru, Ecuador, you know, they produce different kinds of agricultural goods. So that was very important. And as I said earlier, Argentina is a country that, unlike some other poorer nations, African nations in particular, who were victimized by the vulture funds, Argentina stood up and resisted, right? This offensive, which has been going on for years, really, but it has intensified in the past year, a couple of years, in the court of Judge Thomas Greese, a federal judge in New York, who's always ruled on behalf, in favor of the Vulture Fund. The president, Cristina Fernandez, has said, no, we're not going to give in, we're not going to pay. This is who we are. We're for development. We're not going to sacrifice our population for these vulture funds, and has continued with her own policy of development. And China has played a crucial role in helping to stabilize Argentina against a currency run, you know, and all sorts of financial dirty tricks coming directly from the empire with the help of their local vultures. So she has been just very steadfast in and saying, you know, in the way that the press covers the BRICS, they don't cover the BRICS. It's as if they don't exist, right? So every time they talk about Argentina, it's as if Argentina couldn't possibly resist because it has no allies, it has no friends, it's a pariah. And of course, as President Fernandez says, yes, guess what? We have allies. We just signed these agreements with China. They gave an $11 billion currency swap to help stabilize Argentine reserves because there's huge capital flight. So, I mean, just gives you an idea
of the active part of the alignment.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Speaking of all of these, I remember, I think General El-Sisi, the president of Egypt, sent her a special personal message.
Exactly. Right.
Of support for standing up to these predator marauding troops of Wall Street.
Right. As did the G77. China passed a resolution at the UN, the UNGA.
In that regard, I'd like you, the one thing that stood out in the last 8 months in my mind is Mexico, which you said has ferocious, conflicting and it's subject to tremendous assault, but there was the plan with China for a new rail line from the west coast of Mexico to help serve North America, because it is as it is. You have so much container traffic on the across the Pacific, between back and forth between China and the United States, all through Long Beach and Los Angeles. So this, I guess the place was Nayarit or whatever the name. I'm sorry, I don't remember the name. But this was worked out, and it had to be canceled, right? What's the status?
Well, what was canceled was the high-speed train
project
from Mexico City to Querétaro.
Well, I thought the other one?
The other one is still on the books. From Nayarit, where there was going to be, a plan is to build a deep water port.
Deep water port.
And that would go up to New Mexico, right? As a train link. China Railway was going to build the high-speed train from Mexico to Querétaro, suddenly canceled on the eve of Peña Nieto traveling to the APEC summit.
In November.
Obviously under tremendous pressure from the White House. We sort of know that. And now the bidding is going to start again. China Railway is going to bid again. Supposedly it was canceled to give other companies more opportunity, but other companies have no financing to offer, which China does. So we'll see what happens there. But, you know, Mexico has, timidly, we know that there's a great deal of interest. We know from people from inside Mexico that Peña Nieto's not stupid. He knows that that represents an enormous opportunity from China, and that the U.S. cannot possibly offer Mexico anything remotely like what China can. So clearly, his being here this week, you know that the screws must be turning in terms of what the U.S. is demanding from him, which is the TPP, integrating our economies even further, et cetera, which means the destruction of Mexico.
Well, let me ask you this in the final minutes, because one situation brings everything together most movingly, most dramatically, in terms of morality, physical economy, and that's the situation of Haiti. Haiti and the Dominican Republic and the island of Hispaniola that you personally wrote about and campaigned that we should have after the earthquake, have an intervention, and Mr. LaRouche intervened. People, and we know that many people in the United States went to the White House and said, we must intervene, send the Army Corps of Engineers, save people, move them to higher ground, rebuild, none of which was done. Obama said no. And what happened is within months, what was it, Cynthia? Cholera.
Right, in October of 2010.
And we have hemorrhagic dengue throughout the Caribbean. So we've been describing the tremendous initiative for mankind. You don't do it. You see that in Ebola. You see that in dengue and cholera in the Caribbean. Would you give the situation report on this?
Haiti, what can I say? It's a travesty. It's a tragedy. It's genocide, which was the policy and is the policy. After 4 years, Haiti still has no clean water. It still has no sanitation infrastructure. It still has no housing. It has none of the most fundamental elements of required for human survival. And just 2 days ago, the health minister had to deny that there was an Ebola case in Haiti. Haiti would be ripe for Ebola, and if it ever occurred there, it would be a wildfire because of the still infrahuman conditions existing in that island. Dominican Republic, cholera recently, there was another upsurge of cholera in Haiti. Cholera also exists in the Dominican Republic. You have this incredible chikungunya epidemic, which is a mosquito-borne illness also, sweeping the whole Caribbean. And think of the Caribbean as, of course, the legacy of the British Empire, right, of slavery. I mean, the Caribbean has been abandoned to its own fate. And so look at the headlines of any Caribbean newspaper on any given day. Drug murders, drug gang murders, violence. You know, you want to think of the island paradises. There is no such thing. It's just horror. And so these nations also flocked to Beijing, right, because that for them represents some hope. But Haiti is a black mark on our history. Unlike, go back to the 19th century with Lincoln, and the sense that was given there is that Haiti could have, you know, we had a common interest, even back to the period of their own revolution in 1804, where Alexander Hamilton helped to write their constitution.
Oh, is that? Uh-huh.
Right. So you have a history of an American system input there, which has to be revived.
Mm. Oh, yeah. That's... Well, I think that, I guess that brings to a conclusion what we're talking about, and that's an impetus to do something. I just think of these evil figures, the man who was head of the U.S. Agency for International Development, who was groomed by Bill Gates at the Bill Gates Foundation. He's just, Dr. Rajiv Shah is retiring from the AID. And he's the one that implemented such things as huts to live in Haiti with no sanitation, no running water, no electricity. Implemented so-called development projects like Bill Gates talks about in Africa, where there are public-private partnerships and U.S. money was spent for Coca-Cola to have gathering warehouses for mango pulp to produce mango drinks in the United States, and this was supposed to be good for Haiti. This stuff is so evil. I mean, it makes Jeremy Bentham, Adam Smith look like good guys. And so we hope that's the end of the era for that. That's what we're working for. So I thank you, Cynthia Rush from EIR, our Ibero-America correspondent, for this January 10th, the LaRouche Show. But I want to say in conclusion, we won't have January 17th. There's a very important Schiller Institute meeting in New York City that weekend. On the 17th, please look on LaRouchePub.com website for more, or look on LaRouchePAC.com. There are meetings all around the country for mobilizing the United States to join just the effort we've been talking about, the BRICS drive for the World Land Bridge Development for Humanity. So with that, this is Marcia Mary Baker signing off for the January 10th, 2015 LaRouche Show. Thanks.